You're listening to the Business of Biodiversity podcast, proudly brought to you by the New South Wales Government's Saving Our Species program. I'm your host, Edgars Greste. Through poetry, paintings and novels, we all know that drought is an enduring feature of the Australian landscape. Unfortunately, droughts will become more frequent, severe and longer lasting in many regions as the climate changes. When we think of drought, what often comes to mind is the impact on farmers and the food and the fibre they produce that you and I consume. But there's also a broader impact on native plants, animals and their habitats, some of which are under threat. One example is the box gum grassy woodlands along the east coast of Australia. Once upon a time, you could have walked from Melbourne to Sydney within that woodland. But now, 95% of the ecological community has been cleared. The remaining box gum grassy woodlands are found mostly on farmland, and these remaining woodlands are home to more than 33% of Australia's land bird species, including very rare species like the Regent Honeyeater and Swift Parrot. So supporting farmers to care for this vital habitat is crucial.
Australia's lost 33 species of mammals. The US, continental US, has lost one. So by any yardstick imaginable, this country needs to do far, far better than what it's done. And I think we've got the scientific integrity and we've got enough really good land managers to actually make a difference.
David Lindenmayer is a professor of ecology at the Australian National University. And he works with farmers to build resilience to drought and repair habitat for our threatened species. David, you've spent a large part of your career dedicated to research into ecology. I wanted to know, what is it that made you head in this direction? What was the spark that made you so curious about ecology and biodiversity?
My parents used to do these epic car drives. And this was in the days before there were DVD players and you could download Netflix and all sorts of other stuff on your tablet or on your phone even. There was no radio that you could pick up any signals anywhere except in the cities. And so we had these prolonged drives from Melbourne to Queensland, Canberra to Adelaide, Canberra to Hervey Bay. And they were really prolonged periods of time in a car with nothing to do. You can only play I Spy for about 30 minutes and you're done. And I used to spend hours after hours after hour looking out the window, looking at landscapes, thinking about how they fitted together. When I was a teenager, my father got into bird watching. And I was intrigued by these people that only needed to hear a bird fart from 400 metres and they knew what it was. It's just phenomenal. And I suppose that started to absorb that. And then I inherited a musical ear from my mother. So my mother was a concert pianist. And I hated playing music when I was a kid, which I really regret giving up now. But I inherited a musical ear, and that's really important for bird calls. And then my father, who was also a singer, was very good with bird calls. And then I just got more and more interested in those things. And initially I wanted to be a marine biologist. So I went to Townsville and did a lot of diving and studied up there. But really forests and that kind of thing really got me going. And so when I came back from Townsville and started studying forests and forest ecology and those kinds of things. I got started in that. And then I had a job in the wet forests of Victoria in 1983, and it's kind of gone on ever since. It's a way of life, but it's also a passion.
Fast forward over a quarter of a century, and you've published countless scientific papers and books and are recognised around the world for your work in biodiversity conservation. And I wanted to ask you about the work you're doing out in the field. You lead the Sustainable Farms team from the Australian National University, which won the Biodiversity Award for the New South Wales Sustainability Awards back in 2022. I understand it brings together farmers, government agencies, industry groups and land care. Can you give me a sense of the landscape scale that you're working in?
Our biggest study in terms of area and numbers of sites spans the woodlands from central Victoria all the way to northern New South Wales and even at various stages across the border into Queensland. And the area that we cover is almost the size of France. And the work really is about how are the natural assets on farms changing in their condition and how do elements of the biodiversity respond to those changes. So if we renovate a farm dam, if we put an understory into a shelter belt, if we change grazing practices, what are the biodiversity dividends that we see from those interventions in terms of the changes in birds or mammals or reptiles or some of the plant species?
Just stepping back and looking at the impacts on species, what are some of the biggest threats to species and biodiversity decline in terms of the areas that you're working on?
Well, there's no doubt that drought does cause massive stress, and there's no doubt that there's a big impact on the natural environment as well as the livestock and cropping markets and those natural assets in agricultural areas. But the biggest threat in these temperate woodland ecosystems is the amount of land clearing that's taken place, and in some places in New South Wales still taking place. So I think it's really important for people to understand the sheer scale of what's going on here. If you came to Australia in 1788, it would have been possible to walk from Melbourne to Brisbane through almost continuous temperate woodland. And in the last 220 years or so, depending on which ecosystem you're dealing with, between 95 and 99% of that set of environments has been cleared. So this is one of the most extensively modified biomes anywhere on the planet. That's what we're dealing with here. But the thing that's really quite remarkable is that there's still a huge amount of biodiversity that persists in these heavily disturbed environments. And what the data shows from the long-term studies is that it is possible to start to reverse some of that biodiversity decline with good management and good science-based interventions, which is exactly where the sustainable farms work takes place.
Looking at the work that you're doing with sustainable farms, with such large biodiversity changes that we've made to these landscapes, there are also huge climatic changes that have happened as well. You know, we're seeing more intense weather patterns, be they longer droughts, intense rainfall periods. And when we're sort of thinking about these events, often there's this assumption that it's something that landowners have no control over. How can farmers reduce the impacts of intense weather patterns on the landscape?
Drought impacts tend to be less extreme in landscapes that have a more intact vegetation fabric, as it were, to support those systems. So one of the things that emerges from that work, which we've actually been able to demonstrate quite strongly, is that farms and landscapes with more native vegetation cover tend to be much more drought resilient than those landscapes and farms that have very limited vegetation cover.
David says that when times are good, when the system isn't under stress, we don't really notice the significance of remnant vegetation. But we do see strong effects of them during the maximum periods of drought, and particularly certain kinds of vegetation like plantings and restoration areas.
They become really important as refuges for woodland birds, particularly birds of conservation concern, which are often small-bodied birds. We see those effects really magnified during droughts. Some of the ways that modern farming needs to think about the challenges that come with, for example, climate change, the hotter it gets, the more evaporation you have, the less that water persists on your property, the more marginal your grazing enterprises become. So it's really taken a couple of drought cycles and a couple of very wet cycles to see this effect really strongly borne out, that replantings and restored areas play a really important role. So a key part of biodiversity resilience then is to make sure that you've got a diverse range of natural assets, including native vegetation cover on your farm.
The thing about resilience is that it's kind of like insurance, a buffer against climate extremes. And sometimes we don't appreciate it until the dry sets in. Jamie Dawes is a project manager with the East Gippsland Catchment Management Authority, who works with farmers on a number of drought resilience programs. And she says that it's really important to understand landscape function and our place in it.
Drought has lots of different impacts on systems, whether they're natural systems like an ecosystem or a more managed system like a farm. When you're looking at landscape scale health, it's all interlinked. So you see it across the whole landscape. When there's less water available, you'll have less biodiversity in the soil, whether it's on a farm or whether it's in the bush. It's It's all one and the same. We're trying to get the farmers as land managers to look at it as a whole of ecosystem kind of way of looking at it, as a landscape rather than just one paddock. And obviously things like bees and birds, those kinds of things, they're using paddocks and they're using natural environments. It's all one and the same through the eyes of a bird.
Getting that bird's eye view and making that connection between ecosystem function and farm productivity is key to the success of the programs that Jamie runs. And she says that it all starts with looking after the soil.
So we encourage the farmers to direct their focus on maintaining a really healthy ground cover on their farms. So if you've got something covering your soil, it protects your soil, whether it's wet conditions where you can have water runoff causing erosion, or whether it's dry conditions where you can get wind blowing your topsoil away and impacting that productivity.
But wind erosion from intense dry periods and prolonged droughts doesn't just impact farm productivity. It can be felt in cities as giant dust storms, and the impact can be 10 times more costly than in rural areas. Things like the Red Dawn event of 2009 that covered the East Coast in red dust cost over $300 million in cleanup costs and lost productivity. And that lost soil is also full of beneficial nutrients for farmers. So that topsoil is incredibly valuable.
Just to speak in broad terms, your topsoil health is the overall health of your whole farm. Having healthy soil usually translates to soil that has a healthy flow of water. So when it rains, the water can trickle through the soil layers and it's not just bogging down and turning the whole place to mud. But circling back to drought, when you've got a healthy level of organic matter in your soil, it can retain water for longer. So soil that's high in organic matter has that healthy function and water can move through it properly.
The healthy flow of water in both dry and wet times is a great example where resilience is not a thing, but a function. And the importance of healthy soil function can't be understated. For every 1% increase in organic matter, the soil can hold over 60,000 litres of plant available water per acre. Another function of resilience is temperature reduction provided by things like trees. Shaded surfaces can be up to 15 to 25 degrees cooler in the heat of the day. And along with providing water in the environment through evapotranspiration, they can protect biodiversity from dehydration and sunstroke.
We've all seen those paddocks with heaps of black cows all standing together in the sun. No protection whatsoever from the sun. You feel sorry for the poor buggers. So first and foremost, it's a good protection from the elements for the stock. And also circling back to the impacts that it has on the soil. So having the tree in the paddock, and you can picture as the sun's moving, kind of the circle around the tree that gets a little bit of relief from the glare of the sun. It helps to, you know, protect whatever's growing on the soil there, and also helping a little retaining that moisture that's within the soil. There's this big kind of shift towards looking at the farm as a function of the system that it's in, rather than just a business that's kind of separate to everything that's going on around it. And that kind of links well with the projects that we run. They're very much farmer-led. We'll do, you know, some little trials in different paddocks to see what works. And a lot of the time we've got neighbouring farmers talking to their mate over the fence and saying, that little patch you've got growing down there is working really well. What are you doing? It's really interesting watching everyone learning together.
We've all heard the saying, strength in numbers. And no farm is an island. So part of building resilience for farms is to reconnect them as a patchwork of ecosystems across the landscape. And the glue that holds them together is biodiversity. From trees, plants and grasses providing food and habitat, to animals and bugs in the food chain. Different things thrive in different conditions. So the more biodiverse a landscape, the more resilient it can be to drought and other extremes. For David Lindenmayer from the Sustainable Farms Project we heard from earlier, the number of birds and species diversity are a way of monitoring and measuring the success of the rehabilitation work that he's doing.
There are some special birds that come into some of those ecosystems over time with good management. Rufous whistler, leaden flycatcher, crested tri-tit, some of these really charismatic birds. One of the things that's important is we don't only look at the identities of the particular species coming into the system, we also look at their functional role.
And whether you're on a rural property or in an urban garden, birds play a really crucial role as bug catchers, pollinators, and seed spreaders. And as you create habitat for them, they also act as an indicator of healthy landscapes, what David calls functional richness and functional evenness.
The bird response in particular is very interesting, because what they're really telling us is that we are increasing the range of ecological functions on a farm. And that is a really important part about the link between agricultural productivity and the importance of biodiversity conservation in the same space.
That's really interesting, because there's often this misconception that conservation and production can't coexist. And along the line of reimagining our circumstances, you know, often there's this perception that drought happens to us and that we have no control over things. And I was wondering if you can share a little bit about mindset shifts that farmers have experienced through the project.
That's been a fantastic part of the journey. You know, when we first started, we had quite a lot of landowners that would say to us, well, there's no point in being on our farm. We don't have any remnant vegetation. You know, you're wasting your time. And we'd already been on these farms as part of scoping out the pilot work for designing some of these studies. And you'd see these huge patches of white box and beautiful stands of yellow box or Blakely's red gum. And it's kind of like, oh my God, they actually do have really important areas here. And they would say, oh yeah, you can put your sites in just as long as you shut the gates. That's all. We don't really care. And then after a year or two, because we would send out a little report every time we did a survey of what we'd found, we know that they were calling each other and saying, did you get a rainbow beater? Did you get a hooded robin? Wow, you know, these guys got superb parrots. Did you get superb parrots? You know, that kind of stuff. You know, we go to Landcare meetings now and they'll be boasting that their place has got 135 bird species and whatever, and they're looking forward to the next time ANU comes out. And that's really gratifying, and particularly when you've got landowners that come to you and say, well, I've fixed up most of my dams now and I've fenced out that gully and it's stopped cutting back so it's not eroding as much, and tell me, what can I do next? And so often this is industry-led, where farmers kind of say, well, tell us what you know about how to do a good shelter belt so that it has a biodiversity value. What do we need to do? Where should it be? How wide should it be? You know, those kinds of things. So we can use our scientific data, our long-term monitoring data, to suggest some of the things that can be done in this space to make a difference.
David says that for many farmers, the Sustainable Farms Project hasn't only transformed how they view the landscape, but it's also improved their business bottom line.
One of the most profound ones was the change in grazing practices from intense set stocking grazing, where graziers really hit their properties very hard and have constant grazing in paddocks, which tend to get degraded. But then to see the contrast, particularly this happens during and after droughts, where farmers sort of think, we can't do grazing in this way anymore. And to watch them go to a different grazing regime, where they're moving animals constantly, animals have very limited time in a given paddock.
This is called rotational grazing, where farmers actually use environmental cues, like how much grass availability there is, to guide decision-making about when to move livestock or even sell them to minimise the impacts of tough times.
So, for example, instead of making $100,000 a year but spending $90,000 a year on hand-feeding your livestock, you might make $70,000 a year and you might spend $10,000 a year working with your livestock. So your margin goes from $10,000 to $60,000. And that's been a real revelation for many of our landowners that we work with. But more than that, it actually has had a big effect on their mental health, not only because of the changes in financial pressure, but also because of the changes in the environmental conditions on their properties. Their places are in much better health. And that then is reflected on how they perceive their farm, particularly during very difficult times like droughts, but also their sense of better stewardship of their land and this general sort of ethos of wanting to have a farm that is in better condition after their management than it was when they first walked onto the farm.
I'm Gillian from South Gippsland, and my husband and I have a beef cattle farm, and I'm also really heavily involved in Landcare. I've always been really interested in the potential for farm dams to be enhanced for both farm productivity and biodiversity purposes. For me, it's a bit of a no-brainer. Whenever you have water, you don't have to do very much to encourage the biodiversity. And it also makes farms look like such attractive places when you have a nicely vegetated dam. So I've been involved in a couple of projects in the past to do with encouraging farmers to manage their stock better around riparian areas, so creeks, etc. And I guess it was an extension of that. Why can't you treat a farm dam as a really important riparian area?
It's about seeing the farm, or in this case, the farm dam, as a mini ecosystem in the broader environment. And for Gillian, that change in perspective has come from lived experience with her own farm.
When we bought the home farm and we had a dam there, a spring-fed dam, that it was open to the stock, that was their water source. Because we're in such a windy area and we're on sand, whenever I walked past it, it just made me feel really sad because it always looked so exposed and it was eroding. Stock would stand in it and poo and wee in it. And we realised that that dam was going to be the best water source for us to feed a new reticulation system. And so we fenced it off and we revegetated it. And that was, I think, maybe 6 years ago. And it's just so beautiful now. And we don't have the massive evaporation, of course, which we had when the other dam was just exposed. We've preserved the soil and we've got much nicer, cleaner water for the stock. And when you go in there, the frog noise is extraordinary. There's birds. Last season I went in and there was this beautiful grebe nest in the water with a little egg in it. And that just gave me such a buzz. That's why I'd love to encourage more people to do what we're doing with their dam, because it's low-hanging fruit if you want to improve biodiversity.
There is a real thirst for knowledge. You know, for 50, 60 years, farmers got a tax deduction for cutting down all their trees. Now there's a recognition they've got to put a lot of trees back in the landscape, and helping them to use some good science to how to guide that, I think, is pretty interesting and exciting. I love being out in the forest. It's really spiritual for me. I'm not a religious person in any way, but I love being in forests.
Do you have a special place that you long to get to that recharges your batteries, that energizes you to go back on and continue the work that you do?
There's several. One is the wet forests of Victoria. There's some old growth forest that I go to regularly to do bird plots. They're deep in the water catchments. It's one of the few parts of mainland Australia that's had no logging history. There's an ambience and atmosphere, almost cathedral-like, that goes with counting birds in a place where the trees are 85 metres tall. You get this amazing amphitheatre of sound around you, and your brain's working in real time, picking the different calls, grey fantail, rufous fantail, white-throated tree creeper, red-browed tree creeper, that kind of thing. So you've just got this computer going between your ears of decoding these things. And of course, many of the bird species have got different calls between males and females. Eastern whipbird, the male does a whip crack and the female answers. So they do a duet. I love doing the bird counts wherever we are. Yeah, there's a special spiritual nature and psyche that goes with it. Sustainability is not a place, it's a journey. There won't be a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, because we've just got to keep moving towards it as we learn more about how to do things better. I suppose in this latter part of my life, I've still hopefully got another 20, 25 years of useful contribution. Trying to conserve and save as much biodiversity, I think, is a really important contribution that I might be able to make to this great country that we live in.
To build on the work that you want to continue doing, what are the changes do you think that we can make as a nation to reverse biodiversity decline, to enhance threatened species, and thinking about the role that, I guess, individuals, but perhaps on an organizational level, you know, what are the things that we can change to make things better?
I think there's a lot of things that we can do in this country. I think a government's priorities are reflected in their investment. And to make that investment better, we need to be smarter about it. We need to use the best possible science and the best possible monitoring in particular to understand how effective our interventions are. We didn't know how well we could renovate farm dams until we started on these projects to monitor what makes a good farm dam and what's not such a good farm dam and how we can change the not so good ones.
And renovating farm dams is just one of many adaptations that farmers can make. With nearly 20 years of collected data, David and his team have developed a powerful, award-winning online tool called Birdcast, which helps farmers identify management actions to support conservation of birds on their properties. But David says that in order for land managers and the public in general to care about taking action, we all need to reconnect with nature.
I think Australians need to take greater ownership of their own natural heritage. You know, Australia is highly urbanised, but we have this myth about the great Australian bushman or bushwoman. But the majority of Australians have no idea about most of the important things environmentally in this country. And so we've got to re-educate ourselves as to why some of these things are so important. You know, and it goes beyond koalas and kangaroos to a whole range of other species and a whole range of ecosystems and environments that simply aren't anywhere else. And our custodial role in that natural heritage is critical, be it on farms, in forests, in heathlands, in the oceans. We need to step up and make sure that we maintain those environments, because it's part of being human to connect with those kinds of places as well.
This podcast has been produced by Grow Love Project with support from the New South Wales Government's Saving Our Species program. To hear more episodes, make sure to subscribe in your favourite podcast player. And for more information about the Saving Our Species program, visit savingourspecies.online/podcast. Thanks for listening.